Luxury, my man, what's up?
Diallo, man, I'm having such...
Nobody cares. Listen, welcome to One Song.
You do not want to hear about my day? Okay, that's fine. I understand.
I absolutely do.
This podcast is not called One Day. It's called One Song. We're here to talk about a song, not my day.
It's not called A Day in the Life, man.
Fair enough.
Dude, the artist we're talking about today is quite literally everywhere.
That's right, Diallo. Lately, we have seen this artist portrayed on the silver screen here in Hollywood. Murals of him are painted all over the world. His poster is a favorite in college dorm rooms.
At least when we were in college dorm rooms. To be clear, we haven't been in any college dorm rooms in a long time.
I have not recently been in a college dorm room, but it's probably safe to assume that he continues to be an icon for stoners everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's hard to verify his exact album sales, but he's estimated to have sold over 75 million records worldwide.
Mm.
He's one of the most popular musicians of all time, and his music is so universally loved and celebrated, it can at times seem a little bit too ubiquitous.
That's right, Luxury. Today's artist is so widely played that I sometimes wonder if we've really stopped hearing his music.
Yeah, actually hearing it. That's a good point.
Yeah. But all that changes today on this podcast, because you're going to hear Bob Marley and his masterpiece jamming like never before.
I was wondering how you were going to say that word, jamming, because it sounds a little funny with the G at the end.
There's actually a G at the end.
There's a G at the end, but he doesn't sing it that way.
But I'm showing my respect by not using a fake patois.
I'm not doing fake patois. I'm going right down the middle, jamming.
Okay, jamming. We can do jamming.
Song's jamming. Let's
today,
do jamming today.
On one song, we'll be jamming. This is One Song. Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Nexco, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
All right, I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury, also known as the guy who talks about...
You know, shout out to all the people who have tried to give me a catchphrase.
Yeah.
A lot of people say I say shout
top,
out a lot.
Do you have a top three? Or
I think right now my favorite is, somebody suggested it could be infuriating, which is good because I didn't realize I say infuriating
like,
a lot.
Oh, I thought it was a slam on me.
But it kind of works on many levels. Every time you say interpolation, I'll say infuriating.
Well, when I use the sampler.
Yeah, those watching on YouTube can see me visually die a little bit
visually
inside.
Visually infuriated.
But we'll keep workshopping that. Okay, so Luxury, I want to start here. It's our thesis statement about Bob Marley's music and this idea that Marley is so iconic. And it almost distances you from an artist that you think you know, but some of us have just not investigated as much as others. I think it goes back to this. You said it in the opening, like, in my mind, I always think about being a student at Harvard and going into, you know, every dude's dorm room and they've got the Legends poster up. And by the way, I'll say...
And they're smoking weed, right?
Disclaimer right at the top. Yeah. I have tried to do weed. It's just... not every chemical
for
everybody.
It's not for me either, you know? That's funny. We have that connection.
I don't respond to it the same
I don't either.
Way.
I fall right asleep. I was never a weed guy.
But there's an artist there, and there's a reason why his music is globally powerful and globally popular, and I think we just really need to listen to his music differently as if for the first time.
I think that's right. Bob Marley is iconic. He is a global cultural ambassador for Jamaica for the idea of revolution and resistance and politics in music. Yeah. Like, he almost perfected that. It existed before him, but his entire body of work is a new version, a new level of bringing politics and love and Rastafarianism and all of this together in this one body of work and in his oeuvre. He's a very important artist. We love him. He, for all the reasons you just said, sometimes can be two people representing an idea very different from what the actual artist is, who the actual artist is.
Well, can I have, yeah, throw out one more thing? We've said on the show before, like, I really liked The Cure as a kid. And
I wasn't expecting
because
that
I was in an all-black school, I didn't know there was a whole, like, clothing style and a like an attitude that you had to adopt to be a fan of The Cure.
You didn't know about goth?
I didn't know, really. I mean, I saw a couple of movies in the 80s.
Cure abstracted from goth? What even is that?
I saw a couple of movies in the 80s, and I was like, oh, that looks a little extreme. But, like, I didn't let, because I wasn't around it, I didn't let the fandom of the artist sort of get in the way of my appreciation of the music.
That's probably
and I think
the
similarly,
best way,
you know, I also have, and you're going to hear a lot about him in this episode. I know he listens to the podcast. Shout out to my brother. He was a Rastafarian for over a decade, and with dreadlocks and the whole thing. And he had such a love of Robert Nesta Marley that there was no way for me to like get into it without sort of feeling like, oh, I'm just listening to Tony's music. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right,
I say all that just to say that that was sort of my barrier to the music. But now we're going to hear the music.
We're going to talk about Bob Marley. We're going to talk about how specific and individual he was as an artist, like literally even in the genre of reggae. To a lot of people, I think what we're referring to is this phenomenon that for a lot of people who aren't big reggae fans, reggae may to them mean Bob Marley, but reggae and Bob Marley are not one and the same. There's a big difference. He is a very specific slice.
And he's a major figure.
Major figure.
Major figure.
We'll talk about several of the major figures in his life, but there's a reason why he broke through to these white audiences in the frat room, you know, dorm wall posters, because that was by design. It's not an accident that Bob Marley appeals to so many white people in America, because that was a marketing plan that succeeded. We're going to talk about that today. And Chris Blackwell
and Island
Records.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait to talk about that, because the band themselves were stressed out about that. They would do these sold-out shows in America, and they'd look out there and they'd be like, where are the black people?
It caused the implosion of one of the first versions of the band ended because of that change.
Totally. I want to make one note, though, to people like my brother. Hey, look. We have lots of facts for you as well. We always come into this episode with, we hope, sort of like information for people who don't know the artist that well, but also plenty of fun, wonderful facts that we hope that you have not heard before. We did our research for this one. This one consumed so much time. We knew the movie was going to come out. We're going to talk about the movie a little bit towards the end of the show. But Luxury, before we get into the stems, I want you to give the One Song Nation the Bob Marley backstory.
Let's talk a little bit about, as you said, Robert Nesta Marley. Yeah. By the way, first thing, exactly building on what you just said, this little disclaimer at the top, this is the ultimate episode where, because it's such an oral history where different accounts are all...
Different people have different stories
that change over time. Yeah. And we've both seen the documentaries. I've read a number of books. There's one in particular by Roger Steffens I'd recommend called So Much Things to Say. But that 2012 documentary was great too. The bottom line is many stories are told from many angles and many facts are disputed.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into some of the disputes later on because they extend to the music itself. And there's a lot of people who are crediting themselves with having written certain songs, and not a lot of agreement about it.
You sell 75 million records.
Yeah.
There are going to be some lawsuits.
Where there's a hit, there's a writ, as they say. Yeah.
Luxury, before we get into the music, I want to give the One Song Nation just an idea of Bob Marley's childhood. He's born February 6, 1945, in the just a rural place, 9 Mile, St. Anne, Jamaica.
It's like on a hill, like he's literally rural.
Dude,
on the hillside.
First thing I thought, I was like, oh, Eminem, 8 Mile, Bob Marley, 9 Mile. If you're going to give birth to a famous musician, a legend, try and find a street with the word mile in the name, apparently. They said he grew up among the Pennywallies, which I think is like the most beautiful term I've ever heard for fireflies.
I had never heard that word before.
They're like, he grew up among the Pennywallies. There goes the fake patois. I'm not going to do that whole episode, I swear to God. And they called him a red pickney, and I didn't know what that meant. The American equivalent would be red bone. In other words, he was light-skinned. This is because his father was Captain Norval Marley, a 60-year-old British man who worked in Jamaica and met Marley's mom, a black woman. You can't call her a black woman. She was 16 at the time.
Yeah.
He was in his 60s. She was 16. They only knew each other briefly. But because of his parentage, he was what they would call half-caste. And to a certain extent, that made him an outcast. His uncles gave him more work to do with the horses just because, you know, to a certain extent, they weren't sure how to claim him. And so in this just very rural setting, you know, Bob has his first exposure to music. They said that from the time he was a child, he would sing, you know, some of his favorite songs for people. And, you know, they would beat on boxes, the Roomba box and the banjo.
Yeah.
Marley's playing all this stuff in Jamaica. And then at some point, his mom moves from, you know, the mountains and this rural part. She moves to Trenchtown. And this is a very formative time in Marley's life because, you know, there are more people here. And he talks about, you know, there were the bad guys, so to speak, you know, the gangsters, for the lack of a better
boys.
Term.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but he's soaking all this in, and people liked Marley, and they said that, you know, he was a person who had a lot of charm, you know, right from the beginning, right in the early days of his childhood.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, like, the story of Bob Marley is the story of an outcast, and it really, knowing his backstory really helps you understand his music. He didn't feel like he fit in with the white people or the black people. He didn't fit in with his own family. He was very much an outcast and a rebel not by his own making. And he obviously channeled all that into his music. That's where he put everything, all of his
emotions.
But
I also got the impression that it was through his music that he was able to really connect with people. And it was through music that he was able to find his home in the black Jamaican community.
Perfectly put, because we're going to talk also on this episode. There's a number of unsung, I would say, or differently sung, there's a cast of hundreds that made Bob Marley's music popular.
Yes.
A handful of these people, though, very much seem like father figures when you read about them. So we're going to talk about Cox and Dodd. We're going to talk about Joe Higgs, Lee Scratch Perry. We're also going to talk about kind of an overly sung figure, in my opinion, which would be Chris Blackwell. Very controversial. Obviously made him a global superstar, the head of Island Records. But at the same time, you know, possibly took a little more credit than deserved. We'll talk about all these guys on this episode today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to set the stage. It's Jamaica. It's 1962. This is when Jamaica gets its independence from England. By the way, independence, but colonialism is still kind of the order of the day. Like, racism doesn't end in Jamaica in 1962,
oh, God, no.
Just because of independence. But it is the beginning, though, of ska. We've talked on another episode. Go to our Sister Nancy episode. It's sort of a sister episode to this one. We get into more depth about the origins of ska into rocksteady into reggae. But it's important to mention this because the earliest music that Bob Marley is making is actually ska music. And I'm going to tell you...
And 1962.
Starting in 62. So... One character I mentioned earlier, an unsung hero in the story, is Joe Higgs. He's known as the godfather of reggae by many. He himself was an early recording artist in the late 50s. He actually had a song in 1958 I'll play for you called Manny O. This is one of the first records ever pressed in Jamaica.
Oh, Manny O, oh, Manny O, why did you go? Why did you go? You leave me all alone, lady. Please come home. Please, please.
So Joe Higgs, who we just heard, is the gentleman who teaches Marley to sing. And at this point, Mr. Marley has met... By the way, he's being called Robbie at this point. He hasn't changed his name to Bob. So Robbie meets another young teenager, they're teenagers, named Neville O'Reilly Livingston, who soon changes his name to Bunny. Mm. And Robbie and Bunny are taught to sing by Joe Higgs, and they meet a third gentleman... I keep saying gentlemen. These are all young teenagers.
These are kids.
And his name is Peter McIntosh, but is soon known as Peter Tosh. The three of them form the Wailers. And
they were trying to figure out what their version of the Impressions.
Right.
And,
that's
you know,
totally
like, so
right.
They were like,
they got the suits on and everything, the jackets.
This idea that the people of Trenchtown, you know, the poor, they were wailing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they become the Wailers.
The Wailers. That's right.
I want to play a snippet by The Impressions, a song called Man Oh Man, because I like to think that. Both Bob Marley and Young Jeezy like this song.
Man, oh man, have you been to Spain?
And for those who probably already guessed, that was sampled in the Young Jeezy song featuring Jay-Z, Go Crazy.
Yeah, old boy, this is the official Hustlers anthem. You getting money? Throw it in the air.
Guess who's possessed? Still smell the blow on my clothes like Krispy Kreme. I was cooking the morning.
I love sampling.
Yeah, sampling's the best.
It's the best sampling. It always goes really hard. So, and by the way, Young Jeezy's talking about some, you know, street stuff in Atlanta. Meanwhile, we're in Trenchtown.
Street stuff's going down
and
here, too.
They're listening to The Impressions, which is you know, the music that Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer are working on themselves. And I just got to play this before we leave the year 1962. This is a snippet of the very first song to feature Bob Marley's vocals. This is a song called Judge Not. And listen to a little bit of the lyrics, because what's crazy is even though this did not, you know, it failed to, you know, achieve a huge amount of success for the group, it does portend, did I use the word portend right? It does predict what Bob Marley will be singing about it later in his career, because you'll hear a sort of political message in it. This is Judge Not.
And say I'm going bad. Who are you to judge me and the life that I live?
Who are you to judge me and the life I live? Bob is 16 here.
Yeah. He's already feeling the scrutiny of, you know,
I know, he's
the
already,
judgment. Yeah.
He's already looking at society and trying to find the hypocrites.
Society's looking at him, and he's getting harassed by the police, as he talks about. And like, yeah, he's feeling it, and comes out in his, he's 16 when he writes the song. It's crazy, the lyrics.
By the way, someone tried to convince him at one point to change his name to Adam Marley. And he was like, no, yeah. I'm Bob.
I'm Bob. Well, let's move on to 1963. At this point, Coxsundod enters the picture. Coxsundod is the legendary founder of Studio One, the first really important label in Jamaican music.
So important to the sound system, so important to the eventual development of the DJ as we think of it today. Like, you know, Coxsundod, he's such a legend.
He's such a legend. He signs the band, the Wailers, and their first single is called Simmer Down. Now, this is a song that when you hear it, you're hearing just the vocals of the band. It's the three boys, Peter, Bob, and Bunny, along with three other members of the band, six total singers. The music is coming from the Scatolites, who are the Studio One house band, basically. And this is Simmer Down from 1963.
Mm. Simmer Down.
I love this story.
So joyful.
Oh, listen. I love the story that when this song comes out, it's so popular in the dance halls that,
yeah,
like,
they keep replaying it over and over again.
They just play it over and over. Like, other songs can't even get in the mix.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that is a, you know.
That song goes to number one in 1964. It's their first single with Studio One.
Yeah.
And it starts a long, actually, 5-6 year period where they're making records for Studio One, but they're really not going anywhere because the records are huge in the dance
hall.
Sound systems. They love them at the sound system, but they're not being played on the radio.
Nobody's playing them on the radio. And this is at a time when, like, you know, there's some straight thuggery happening.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Literally, those guys would show up at your radio station and, you know, basically say, you have to play this, like, right now, or bad things will happen.
It's worth mentioning the sort of gangster element, both of the record industry and politics, which is starting to simmer down. It'll get worse as the story progresses, and it is related to the story. The long story short about this era, and by the way, they're still called the Wailers. It's not Bob Marley and the Wailers. The Wailers stay with Coxsundod in Studio One, and they are making, according to Bunny Wailer, like, a whopping £3 a week. They're very frustrated.
Yeah.
They're not able to tour. They don't have any money. At a certain point, they get tired and they leave Studio One, and they go to work with our second undersung or unsung hero, and one of my favorite, if not my favorite, producer of all time, Lee Scratch Perry, in 1969, enters the picture. Very important figure in Bob's life as a person.
A person you've probably heard about. Yeah. Even if you're not into reggae, you've probably heard of Lee Scratch Perry.
You probably heard of Lee Scratch Perry. He had a very long career. He just passed away a couple years ago and made probably 100, maybe 200 records. Very prolific producer. He's an artist himself. You can hear him singing a lot of his records.
I want to say something about the Jamaican scene in general, because you've made me think about this. On this show, we're big fans of, there are very few people walking around saying, like, oh, sampling isn't art, and, oh, hip-hop, that's not, like, that's something you don't hear very much anymore. But you got to put it in its context. Like, Jamaica at this time is cranking out their own versions of all these American hits.
Right.
You know,
right.
Maybe a couple of British hits, but, like, so many. And in a weird way, like, that's sampling. You know, in a weird way, that's like a do-over. And it made me think that there's so much to be gained from rampant copyright abuse.
if
they weren't covering these songs and doing their own versions of these songs, you know, they might have eventually crossed over to the United States and just done what was happening over there. But because they sort of lived in this weird sort of like bubble, it led to It's sad to say. It seems like copyright abuse leads to some of the best stuff because hip-hop artists didn't know that sampling would one day be known as art. They just were like, we want to move the dance hall. We want to move this crowd. And
you're absolutely right, and it needs to be pointed out that there was literally no such thing as copyright law in Jamaica until the early 1990s.
Oh, wow.
At the same time, there was something known as we know we're being piratey. You know, there was an awareness at times, and we're going to talk a little bit later about some of the conflict, the songwriting conflicts, as was alluded to. And they do exist for Bob Marley songs in a big way. But you're absolutely right, I think about this a lot too, how Jamaica is kind of like a perfect little experiment. What happened if we threw copyright out the window for 20, 30 years? And see what happens creatively. Wonderful things happen musically and creatively. Not such wonderful things necessarily on the finances side.
Where well, I was going to say
the rich get richer, and these musicians, so many of them, sort of die destitute.
Yeah, the Wailers were making a couple of pounds a week.
3 pounds a week. According
who was
to Buddy
making
Wailer.
Money at Studio One? Was there somebody
Cox
like
and Dodd.
Absolutely rich? So it was
Cox and
Dodd. Cox's pocketing.
If you owned a studio, then you made money. If you owned a sound system, Duke Reed, Cox and Dodd, all these guys, Chris Blackwell, who's about to enter the picture. It's the record labels and the studio owners who are often one and the same. So getting back to Lee Scratch Perry for a moment, I want to talk about how Lee Scratch Perry, again, in 1969, is already an artist. He also has a number 5 record in the UK, and his band is called The Upsetters. And it's kind of, we were just talking about Motown, it's kind of like the Funk Brothers, where there are a bunch of artists who come and go from the operation.
Yeah.
So the Upsetters aren't just the same drummer, bass player, keyboard player, etc. They rotate. And he's unable to get a band to tour with him. So he finds a couple of brothers, the Barrett Brothers, who are two more unsung heroes of the story of Bob Marley.
I was just learning about them, but man, Carlton Family Man.
That's right. Astin Family Man Barrett is the bass player and Carlton is the drummer. And the two of them are in a band called the Hippie Boys. And when they learn that the Upsetters need a new rhythm section, they join up. So Lee Scratch Perry has the Upsetters with the Barrett Brothers in it. And this is when Bob Marley enters the picture and he's just left Cox and Dodd. Not only does he need a new producer, he needs a new band. So this next chapter...
Correct me if I'm wrong. Lee Scratch had also worked with Coxon and was also tired of some of Coxon's business
that's
practices.
Right.
So that, so
he strikes out on his own.
They felt like they had been through that ringer together, and so now they're joining outside of that
circle. Absolutely right, Dale. They're bonded in their disdain, or in their frustration, I suppose, and striking out on their own from the confines of Studio One and Coxon Dodd.
Yeah.
So they make a couple of records together, and... It's my contention that these are probably two of my favorite Bob Marley records. They are two of the lesser known records in the catalog because they are hard to find. They're actually not on Spotify. Their ownership is caught up in lots of copyright stuff because this is before Island Records comes in the picture.
Uh-huh.
You can find the record called Soul Rebels. You can find the record called, confusingly, Soul Revolution Part 2. There is no Part 1. But these are the two records that Bob Marley and the Wailers made with Lee Scratch Perry on the
pre-Island Records.
Pre-Island Records. He's the producer and co-writer on a lot of the songs. And this is the beginnings of the Barrett Brothers on bass and drums, who stay with him his entire life, his entire career. So I'd highly recommend you go out and check them out. They're much grittier. If you're a Lee Scratch Perry fan already, you'll find that they're very much in line with his catalogs, like minimal, stripped down approach.
And I love the video footage of him, Lee in the studio, because like you just get this, he's having the greatest time. Like he's bouncing around. They said he was like,
I know exactly the footage you're talking about. As a lifelong fan of the band, there are only like two like clips of him, unfortunately, that seem to have survived from that era, from the early 70s.
It's like at Harvard. I swear they're like two
around.
Pictures. Be happy, kids, that you can document every facet of your life, because I'm always trying to find pictures of me at Harvard. I swear I went, you guys. I totally went to Harvard.
I believe you. I am going to need to see the diploma, though.
I don't have it.
So one more important thing to point out about Lee Scratch Perry's connection to Bob Marley. Mm. Now, Bob Marley lived with Lee Scratch Perry for a while, who sort of treated him like a son. And we talked earlier about the whole
because
father
Marley's
wasn't around
mom
thing.
Moved to the States.
Marley's mom moved to Delaware.
I know.
Bob joined him.
She was like, I can move anywhere in the United States. I'm going to Wilmington, Delaware.
Bob came out to try to join her for a while. He's like, I'm not having this. I'm going to go back to Jamaica where there's sunshine and I don't have to work at the factory floor. I found a quote from, so David Katz is the name of a writer, a reggae specialist and writer. He's written a couple of books. One I highly recommend called Solid Foundation, an Oral History of Reggae. But he's also known as Lee Scratch Perry's biographer. And there's a book called People Funny Boy. It's 400 pages long, and I read the whole thing. He has this great quote, which is very important about what's happening right now in 1969, 1970, with both Lee Scratch Perry, Bob Marley, and reggae as a whole.
Uh-huh.
So he says, Lee Scratch Perry changed the reggae beat. And he used the Whalers as the vehicle for that. And here's the quote from Lee Scratch Perry himself, which I will not do the patois, but picture a patois. "When the people hear what I manna do, them hear a different beat, a slower beat, a waxy beat, like you're stepping in glue. Mm. Them hear a different bass, a rebel bass, coming at you like sticking a gun." This is Small Axe by Bob Marley and the Wailers with Lee Scratch Perry. So if you want a big tree. So this is a moment where we went from ska in 62 to rocksteady in 66, 68, which is a little slower than ska, but it's not quite reggae. And in this moment, Lee Scratch Perry with Bob Marley and the Wailers is helping to craft what becomes known as reggae proper or roots reggae. And this is what carries us through the 70s. And it's all happening right here in this moment. And one more thing that Perry does, which influences Bob Marley, is his voice. This is a quote from Clancy Eccles, another famous Jamaican singer-producer, who said, "Bob Marley never used to sing like how he sings now. He used to sing a different way, but Perry used to sing that way. Perry is how Bob Marley sounds now." And it's true. If you go back and listen to some early Lee Scratch Perry, you'll absolutely hear the connection between how the two of them sing. So they make these two records with Lee Scratch Perry, and then there's a falling out over, guess what? Money, as always. Bunny, in particular, is really fighting for getting paid fairly. Bob has sort of got a different mission in life, and this is carries through his entire life and career, where he has a message to deliver,
yes,
and he ends up making money, but it's never the primary thing. Bunny just wants to eat, poor guy. So there's a big fight. They have a dispute at the... I've read this story several times from all of the different parties' angles. And apparently, Bunny threatens to punch Lee Scratch Perry. They're at a restaurant. They run out. They're running down the street, screaming at each other, wailing at each other, no pun intended. There's a second meeting where they try to make things right. Yeah. But then Peter Tosh thinks that there's like a bottle of acid that Lee Scratch Perry has brought, and then he knocks it to the ground and apparently starts smoking. So it confirms that it was...
acid?
Well, these are all different accounts of this interaction. I don't know what really happened, but there was a very acrimonious and possibly dangerous split that takes place.
Who brings acid to a business meeting?
I guess in Jamaica. Maybe Lee Scratch Perry. If you know about Lee Scratch Perry, it's not that shocking. He may have actually done that. So that's the end of working together with Lee Scratch Perry. Mm-hmm. And it's right around this moment that Chris Blackwell enters the picture.
Yep.
Chris Blackwell is a wealthy white gentleman who's from Jamaica. His mother is apparently Ian Fleming, you know, James Bond author's muse. So he grows up and he's got like some bit part in Dr. No, I think, which is filmed in Jamaica in 1962.
Chris does?
Chris does, yeah. I think he's like a child in that movie.
Oh, check it out.
So Chris Blackwell signed Jimmy Cliff, by the way, which was his first effort. This is really interesting parallel. He tried to make Jimmy Cliff, another Jamaican star, into a global superstar by sending him to Muscle Shoals in Alabama to kind of inflect some American rock into Jamaican reggae. And didn't quite work for a lot of reasons. There is a great movie that comes out of this connection, which is The Harder They Come. Not just a great Jamaican movie, but a great movie. So in 1973, Bob Marley and Peter and Bunny go to England, and they end up taking a meeting with Chris Blackwell, who signs them. So the way they get connected to Chris Blackwell is that apparently, Bunny Whaler tells the story, again with the money, he believed he was owed money because he was aware of Island Records and Chris Blackwell, the owner and founder, only because he understood Lee Scratch Perry had been selling their records in England, and somehow that was connected to Island Records, and somehow he'd never seen a dime out of it. Mm. So he's like, let's go meet this Chris Blackwell character and shake him down. Hopefully he's not bringing any acid to the meeting, but like all these record labels, you know, Bunny's already starting to get a little beaten down and frustrated. This is 3 times in a row he's hearing about somebody else taking his money out of his mouth between Cox and Dodd and Lee Scratch Perry and now maybe Chris Blackwell. So they go to this meeting. They actually end up signing. This is the beginning of this next era of what we kind of, maybe the beginning of what most people know Bob Marley and the Wailers to be musically, because Chris Blackwell starts to change their sound. He adds this, what he tried with Jimmy Cliff before. He's adding American musicians. He's adding cleaner production, 24-track. The difference in sound before and after Island is like 2 different bands.
It really is.
It really is.
And when I think about Bob Marley's music, I do think about that sonically separated, super clean, low bass. Like, you know, it's not the, you know, sort of scratchy, no pun intended, Jamaican ska sound. Like, no, it's that... It's that stuff that sounded great.
That's right. Know? I'll play you a perfect example. This is one of my favorite songs. The original, I should say. I prefer to the re-record. There's a song he did with Lee Scratch Perry called Kaya. This is Bob Marley, Kaya, the original version with Lee Scratch Perry, 1970. And here's that same song again as it was re-recorded for Island Records in 1978 for the album of the same name. This is Kaya, the much different, same song, extraordinarily different production. Got to have Kaya now.
I mean, what's interesting there, there are a couple of things. Obviously, it's mastered very differently.
It's recorded and mixed on a 24-track.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of separation. There's multiple takes were probably made. I would imagine, knowing how Lee Scratch Perry, how quickly he produced records, they were probably like, boom, maybe one to two takes at the most, and then we're done and move on to the next track.
So by 1973, they're on Island Records. They release Catch a Fire. Amazing record, but their market is a black rock act. You know, that's basically what Chris Blackwell thought would be the best way to sell them overseas. And they go to England, and, you know, they're a little underwhelmed by the audience's reaction.
They're playing the club circuit. They're playing these tiny little underground clubs.
They're playing these tiny little clubs. It's important to note that, you know, Bob, for all his, you know, Afrocentric views, he still wants the music to go out and go wide and spread. Bunny and Peter are a little bit more militant than that, quite honestly, just for lack of a better term. They're just like, I don't know if I get this. And right before the U.S. tour, Bunny Wailer leaves the group.
Yeah.
And because he hears, like, you know, some of the places they're going to be playing, he's like, oh, he uses the term freak show. He's like, I don't want to play these freak clubs. You know, he's like, I'm a religious man. Like, I don't do that kind of stuff. I mean, like, you could even make the case that, like, a lot of the things that the hippies were into, like, you know, Bunny Wailer was not with them. So he leaves the group. And then they do the tour. And for most of the tour, Peter is unhappy. And so as soon as the tour is over, Peter leaves the group.
Yeah, he just wants to be home in sunny Jamaica. He's tired of these wintry, you know, the British winters and stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, they hated the British winter. So Bunny and Peter, two very important members of the Wailers, are now gone. And what does Bob do? Well, Bob builds a new group.
He builds a whole new band. He recruits, very importantly, the I3s, which is the name of the backup group.
Yes.
And they are, in and of themselves, an important part of the story. This is Marcia Griffiths, Judy Mowat, and Rita Marley herself are in the band, which means that Bob is touring the world with Rita.
Yeah.
He replaces, the Barrett brothers are still there. He replaces the other members. We'll name them when we get to the Stems in just a moment. But this is the beginning of their rise to global fame. From 74 to 77, they go from these, you know, dinky clubs where Peter and Bunny are not having it and they quit, to rising to the top of playing 50,000 seat stadiums.
Ironically,
and arenas.
It's after Bunny and Peter leave that they start playing the venues that they would have probably enjoyed playing.
This is the global stardom that Chris Blackwell and Bob Marley together had strategized. It worked. The crossing over, they reached a wide audience. They reached a global wide audience. They're still not reaching a huge black audience. That's part of the story we'll get to in a little bit. But this brings us into the song story. So if we're ready to jump into jamming, now is a good time as any. Let's do it.
All right. After the break, Bob Marley's jamming like you've never heard it before. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Did you know Bridgestone developed a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials? Making a difference today for future generations. That's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Nextel, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Nextel, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
Welcome back to One Song. We're about to play the stems for jamming, but first, Luxury, this song was written and recorded under tumultuous circumstances for Bob Marley and for Jamaica. Let me walk us through that really quickly. So, in short, Jamaica had two political parties. One was called the Jamaican Labor Party. They were the conservative party under Edward Seaga. And there was Michael Manley, who had the more leftist People's Nationalist Party. I know that throws people off because, like, labor? It seems like that'd be the left. No, it's the opposite. JLP versus PMP. And they basically had gangs. I mean, like, they had these, you know, organized groups of people with guns, you know, shooting at each other in the streets. Lots of political violence in Jamaica. And Bob sees all this, and so he organizes the Smile Concert, 1976, you know, to help bring, you know, people together. Now, unbeknownst to him, and Bob Marley, look, you know, I think we can figure out a little bit of what his politics were, but he often would say, like, I don't necessarily support the government of Michael Manley. I think that both sides tend to use the people and sort of get what they want without truly helping the people. But he wants unity. He organizes this concert. It happens in December. And, you know, I think sort of taking advantage of a situation, Michael Manley moves the election up towards the concert to make it seem like maybe Bob Marley's giving tacit endorsement to the PMP.
Tensions are riding high.
Yeah, and that increases tensions a lot. At the time, Bob Marley had what was the equivalent of the Secret Service, which was called the Protective Service, looking out for them. One night, the Protective Service suspiciously doesn't show up, and gunmen run into his very famous home at 56 Hope Road and start firing off shots.
Here now is a special item of news. Entertainer and reggae star Bob Marley, Rita Marley, and the manager of the Wailers, Don Taylor, are now patients in the University Hospital after receiving gunshot wounds during a shooting incident tonight.
And there are all these people pointing fingers. Like, the JLP is like, oh, they were shot but not injured because, you know, the PMP wants sympathy. And the PMP is like, no, the JLP is working, you know, with Henry Kissinger and the CIA, and they're trying to kill Bob Marley. Bob Marley bravely takes the stage just 3 days after being non-fatally shot, and takes the stage, and he says he's going to do one song. He ends up doing a 90-minute performance, and it's supposedly one of the greatest performances of all time. There are just 80,000 people, 80,000 Jamaicans listening to Bob Marley, you know, in his prime. I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And after that concert, Marley's gone. He leaves the country. He starts off in Nassau, and he eventually goes to London because, you know, to hear his friends say it, they were like, you know, he was injured. And he was emotionally hurt that something like that could happen in Jamaica. And he didn't want to be bothered on that. He wanted to focus on the creation of his music.
Just on the topic of exile, because essentially that's what happens. He gets on this plane right after the concert and gets the heck out of Dodge. He leaves Jamaica for all of 1977, where he's living with the band in London. They all have their own floors on this, you know, apartment. And this is where they make the album Exodus, which is widely considered to be, in my personal opinion, outside of the Lee Scratch Perry albums, probably the best and most widely beloved Bob Marley record. It's the one with One Love, the re-record, Three Little Birds, Waiting in Vain. and the song we're going to talk about today, Jammin'. All of this is written during this London exile. Little side note, the B-side of Jammin' is a song called Punky Reggae Party. Which is actually Bob Marley reuniting lovingly with Lee Scratch Perry. They had, after 5 years of not speaking, after the acid moment, the acid incident, they get together and they do this B-side. It's an homage to the punk rock movement that's happening in London at the time. They literally name drop The Damned, The Jam, The Clash. They even mentioned The Slits, although that was removed later because they were sexist and decided they shouldn't be name dropping a girl band, which is a little strange. In any case, the song Jammin' is written. They come back to Jamaica in time for this second concert, which is in April 1978. And this is called the One Love Concert. It's held at the National Stadium in Kingston. Very important thing happens at this concert. Do you want to tell us politically, going back to that for a second, kind of a an attempt at reconciliation, I should say.
An attempt at reconciliation, yeah. He brings the leaders of the two major parties, Manley and Ciaga, on stage, and he has them shake hands, and then he takes both their hands and he raises them up.
Really powerful moment.
And the crowd goes nuts.
There's footage of it. It's really powerful
to really
see.
It's really good
footage. You see how uncomfortable these two white men are.
Let's talk about that just real quick, because I too was just like, why are the two leaders of the parties white? They are not considered white in the same way that we consider white in this country. They are considered white Jamaicans.
Yeah.
But it's not quite the same thing. For example, Ciaga, I think, is half Lebanese and his mom is mixed. And Michael Manley is too considered white Jamaican, not the same as white. So it's a very complicated thing. It is jarring.
It is jarring, though, visually.
All these black people.
Right, at this
and
concert.
And their two leaders are, you know, look like Joe Biden and Joe Biden's brother. But it's an interesting, it's obviously a holdover from colonization.
Right.
But this song, Jammin', was, you know, a major part of that One Love Concert.
Well, that's the song that is being played when that moment happens.
Yes.
So it's the perfect entree into our discussion of the song and the stems.
Yes.
Which is next up on One Song. Actually, it's right now. Let's start with the drums. This is Carlton Barrett. I mentioned him earlier, one of the two brothers who were stolen from Lee Scratch Perry, basically. One thing I wanted to just quickly talk about is how reggae drum beats, there are three primary reggae drum beats, especially during this era of the roots reggae, 70s era. One of them, which is by probably the most defining one, is called the One Drop. Now, you've heard this one, and you knew immediately that it was a reggae song, because it's literally where you don't hit anything on the one. The downbeat does not have a kick drum. So the kick drum comes on the two and the four. I'll play you some examples of that, so it'll make sense. This is Crazy Bald Head.
We're gonna chase those crazy bald heads out of town.
And this is one of my favorite examples because, again, the one drop is the absence of the kick drum on the one. That means dun, dun, two, three, four, dun, 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 dun. But you'll also notice that there's some really interesting stuff happening in the hi-hats. That's one of Carlton Barrett's specialties, is just doing really interesting rhythms and patterns on the hi-hat. And it's dropping that downbeat that makes you feel like you're kind of floating or like breathless for a second. And really, it's one of the two things that gives reggae music its reggae-ness. That and the upbeat, the skank happening on the guitar or maybe on keyboards or maybe both.
Yeah.
Between the two of them, that's how, if you wanted to just make a reggae song, you'd start with those two things and you'd sort of build outwards from there. So the one drop is the primary reggae drum beat, but it's not the only one. And actually, Jammin' does not use that one. It uses one called Steppers, which is the kick drum is actually going on eighth notes every beat. And you're still having a lot of play happening on the hi-hat. There's a third one, which is called Rockers, and that is more of a kind of slowed-down funk where it's boom, cat, boom, cat, which is made famous by Sly and Robbie a little bit in the mid-70s around this time.
Makes sense.
So Carlton Barrett here, we're going to hear him play that second type of beat. This is a Steppers beat, which is what he used for the song Jammin'. Pay special attention to how creative he really is with those hi-hats that go between being straight and being swung. The song is swung, a little swing feel, but he's got some moments where he throws in some straight eighths. It's very interesting. So it's very subtle.
Do you hear the swing?
Right.
Absolutely.
The song swings. Da, 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 dun, 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 dun. But it's very subtle to kind of go back and forth between the two. And
it's so funny to hear that there are funk influences. Obviously, we hear it with the bass. I never thought we'd hear it with the drums because funk is so much about hitting on the one.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. And the one. That's the foundation.
And reggae is sort of not that. But
it's literally the opposite of James Brown's philosophy that you're referring to of the one is literally, this is the opposite of the one. On the one in funk, in James Brown, the one is the most important beat. As long as you hit the one, you can kind of do anything until the next one. You can go crazy.
Your homework's done. The rest of the evening's yours. And think about the diaspora at this time, because you've got Bob in Jamaica, you've got James in America, and you've got Fela in Nigeria.
Right.
So the whole diaspora.
And they're all listening to each other.
And they're all listening to each other.
Getting back to the one drop beat for a second, and again, this is steppers, not one drop, but sometimes Carlton is quoted as saying, or other people attribute to him, that he's the originator of one drop. I think one of his nicknames might have been One-y or Droppy, I forget which. But he's not technically the originator. This happens all the time in all forms of music and all forms of things in life. Who was the first ever to do it? But a lot of people say that Lloyd Nibb from the Skatalites, and we heard them, by the way, earlier. When we heard Simmer Down, that drummer was Lloyd Nibb. And you'll hear him doing this thing, which I'm about to mention, which is, besides potentially originating the one drop, being the first to think to do it, he also added a lot of these kind of Niyabingi African rhythms and kind of Cuban and Caribbean rhythms, basically, that are very similar to that hi-hat thing we just heard, how he was throwing out straight and swung and triplets. So I'm going to play again the song Simmer Down, and I'll point out the little moment where Lloyd Nibb from the Skatalites in 1962 was doing a little something similar to what Carlton learned from him, who was one of his proteges, how to do with his hi-hats. He's about to play something on the bell cymbal, which you'll hear, which is of kind of Afro-Cuban pattern. So notice that coming right after the horns play their part, you'll hear a little ding-ding-ding-ding-ding on the bell of the cymbal, basically.
Love that.
So that's just one of the influences that Carlton Barrett brought into his reggae drumming.
Awesome. Also find it interesting that, you know, these Jamaican artists have something called a one drop when we know that in their sort of caste racial system, there was the idea that one drop.
I find that interesting too, and
By the way, Manly and Siaga sort of use that to their advantage.
Right, which is its own troublesome thing. There is also a very famous Bob Marley and the Wailers song called One Drop.
Yeah.
So this idea of one drop has multiple meanings, which I think is what they're playing with. Yeah.
All right, what's the next stem you want to play for us?
Well, let's go to Carlton's brother, Aston Family Man Barrett, on bass.
Awesome.
I'll throw the drums back in there for context.
Now, if you take those drums out, you really do understand the difference between halftime and full on, because that could easily be like a house bass line, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, but it would just be all doom, doom, doo, 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 doo,
yeah.
doo, 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 you know.
You could even do double time.
By the way, you wouldn't even have to necessarily change the cymbals. It's just because of what the kick is doing that it goes to halftime in your brain.
There's not much going on in this bass line in terms of fills and melodic ideas.
We love holding it down. The repetition. Yeah.
The bass, it's all exactly right. It's all about holding it down and keeping it steady. Mm-hmm. There is a pre-chorus, and I'll play that for you just so you can hear some variety in the bass. Yeah. And together, actually, it's interesting. You can really hear the swing that I was mentioning.
Yeah.
There are parts where you're just listening to the drums. You may not feel the swing, but when that bass comes in, he is swinging the bass big time. So the combination is where you hear swing, not swing, happening back and forth in this really interesting way. And finally, there's a sort of B section a little later on before the break, and here's that.
I love that.
So cool, right?
Now, as you know, I don't play a guitar, but I love the guitar part of the song. And I love the story about how tape delay sort of almost like invented this new sound.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I think you're referring to the skank, the offbeat thing. So there's two guitar parts in Jammin', and I'm going to play both of you for them. One of them is Bob, and I believe he's doing the sort of basic skank that you're referring to. And that sounds like this. And And I'll play that for you in context, because where's the downbeat? That's the whole point of reggae. It can really throw you if you don't have context with other instruments. And. It's all
one,
the ands.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three.
And what you just heard enter there, by the way, was Junior Marvin, the second guitar player, the lead player. And the two of them are playing very different parts. The second one, the Junior Marvin part, which is more of a like, it sounds like it's got some wah, maybe some phase going on.
Mm-hmm.
But to your question about the whole skank thing, what you're actually hearing, you're referring to the fact that it is rumored that the earliest ska and rocksteady songs where that skank offbeat thing was happening in the guitar might have been Lynn Tate, one of the early guitar players, might have been Earl Ranglin. Might have been somebody else. There's a story that gets told that it used to get played just like I played it for you, where it's just that one note, the one chick eighth note. And the story that gets told is they got a new piece of equipment at Studio One that was a delay, which made that chick.
And nobody apparently knew how to use it. They were like, what is this thing?
So they turn it on, and it takes those eighth notes into 16th notes. They go from chick, chick, to chicka. Chicka,
right.
Chicka. There's just a little bit of delay after each one. So that becomes the skank. They're both considered skanks, if you will. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way.
I think
that's literally what you call that upchuck. The upchuck also sounds disparaging. Look, this is just what you call these things, okay? Don't shoot the messenger here.
You invented all these terms.
A little bit later on, you can hear more of that Junior Marvin lead guitar. He kind of starts to noodle a little bit more. I love it. I mean, everything in reggae is rhythmic. These are all rhythmic melodic parts, but all of them are creating this groove together. Oh, here's one last thing. And here's a cool little soulful solo at the very end.
I mean, that is so soulful.
So soulful.
I love that.
It's soulful and rocking at the same time.
Remind us who that is?
That's Junior Marvin on lead guitar.
Junior Marvin, man. Yeah. I believe he was not from Jamaica.
Well, he is Jamaican, but he moved to London.
He moved to London.
Age. And there's a fun story about how the year he joined the band, the same day he got the call, he also got a call from Stevie Wonder.
By the way, we have a great Stevie Wonder story coming up, but let's stick with the stems. You've got some keyboards for us.
I got some keyboards from Tyrone Downey. It's mixed a little bit with the percussion from Alvin Seco Patterson. And let's hear what that sounds like. So let's hear a little bit more. What we were just hearing had a mixture of piano and organ. I'm going to play a part that has a little more of the organ isolated, and then you'll hear the i3s popping their beautiful voices in towards the end of it. I love that. The backing vocals are so gorgeous. Here's another moment. Let's give them their flowers. This is Marsha Griffiths, Judy Mowat, and Rita Marley. And here they are, background vocals mixed in with some keyboards and guitar. So I'll add Bob to that just so you can hear how the harmony stack sounds.
We're jamming, and we're jamming in the name of the Lord.
So beautiful.
I gotta say, it is amazing musicianship and amazing songwriting. But it's not the song that we know unless we're talking about Bob's voice. And I think you just proved that. Play us some isolated Bob Marley vocals from jamming.
Okay. I'm going to start with this section, which lyrically is one of my favorites. I'll just play it for you.
No bullet to stop us now. We need a bed. No, we won't bow. Neither can be bought nor sold. We all defend the right. Jaja children must unite. Oh, life is worth much more than gold.
You know, we have to talk about the lyrics a little bit there, because that's one of my favorite lyrics. He says, for those, because again, it's easy to, with his patois and all the music, to not really grasp everything being said. He says, no bullet can stop us now. We neither beg nor we won't bow. Neither can be bought nor sold. We all defend the right. Ja, ja, children must unite. Your life is worth much more than gold. There's so much to unpack
so
there.
So much to unpack
and
there.
And I just want to unpack just a little bit of it now, and we're going to get right back. But
in
like,
light of the history,
no
right?
bullet can stop us. In other words, like the exactly violence isn't going to deter us.
Yeah.
We neither beg, forget your money, or, nor we won't bow. We're not going to be sycophants. Neither can be bought nor sold. You know, money, possession, wealth, again, means, you know, not enough.
Bob because, lived that truth, absolutely.
Yes, yes. Him and Stevie, I think, you know, let's talk about that real quick. Stevie Wonder and Bob Marley play a concert, and Stevie donates the money to charity, and that was so powerful to Bob, and I think that really affected
it was a role model when, thing, yeah.
when, yes, when Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, and they threw out the colonizers. The Zimbabwe people said, hey, will you perform for us? And, you know, his manager sent over the quote. They were like, we ain't got it. And Bob was like, okay, I'll use my own money so that we can perform.
The cost, you mean like the fee?
Yeah. He's like, well, just to move the band and everything, to set up the venue. Bob paid that out of pockets because he felt it was important to be in Zimbabwe.
I think he beat up his own manager, too, because
he kicked him in the chest or something like that. He kicked him, and his manager flew across the room.
It was the beginning of the end for their relationship. That was where Don Taylor started to be on the outs.
Absolutely. But, you know, the fact that he played that concert, and then, of course, there was, you know, there was a bit of a stampede and some tear gas, but it was important for Marley to finish that concert, even on his own dime, where he wasn't making money on the concert.
No African concert is complete without the tear gas.
No, because you know what? Neither can be bought nor sold.
Exactly.
Play us some more vocals from Mr. Marley.
Holy Mount Zion, just seated in Mount Zion, it rules all creation, and we're jamming.
This is gospel music.
Yeah.
You know, it is revolution music, it is political music, but in Rastafarianism, the political and the spiritual go hand in hand. And he's singing about Holy Mount Zion, which I believe in Rastafarianism is not necessarily the place just outside Jerusalem. It's actually considered to be utopia. It could be Ethiopia, but it's just supposed to be the utopia when everybody is treating everybody the way they should be treated.
Yes, this is not a Zionist song, like in the Israel sense of the word.
Let's not say that. Let's not even dip our toe into that.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't mean to Jewish-splain it, but you can say whatever you want, but I don't know. We may not want to step into it.
Well, we don't have to
step
into it.
We're literally saying the Holy Mount Zion.
We're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I know.
Ugh. Well. Down this
I mean, listen, I love the echo in reggae and in dub. Like, to me, it's like such
it's
a defining feature.
It's like outer space.
Why? It's so spacey.
Yeah.
By the way, this was recorded in 1977 when Star Wars is coming out. Like, you know, like, there must have just been something in the water where everybody in the 70s just wanted to go to space. It just seems like maybe it was 2001 or Space
Odyssey. I mean, if you ever go to, like, the Jamaica bin at the record store and you look at the dub records, they're all there's so many like Star Wars like cute illustrations done by hand in that sort of like very individual style where it's like, you know, Darth Vader mask, and like there's definitely a lot of spaceness happening. If you ever look at like Scientist is another dub producer who worked with King Tubby and Prince Jammy. There's a lot of space love. It's all another
space like, getting a lot of love and a lot of love in this song. I really do love the lyrics in the song. When we were talking about what's our Bob Marley episode for this season, we talked about this one because, you know, he says we're jamming in the name of the Lord. Like, there's so much. If you think about the political context that he's singing into with the two leaders on stage, we're jamming in the name of the Lord. Jamming, by the way, there are a couple of ways to interpret the word jamming.
Yeah.
But I think the safest way is to say, you know, dancing and having a good time, essentially partying. And, you know, they're partying
in the name of the Lord. Yeah.
And I think that's wonderful. I also think there's just a lot of great. We talked a little bit about some of the lyrics in this song. He's such a master poet.
Yes.
He's such a master poet. I wanted to bring up one of my favorite Bob Marley lyrics of all time. Is this one lyric from Trenchtown. In this great future, you can't forget your past. It's one of those
so true.
wonderfully circular. Like, right. Lennon does a lot of that.
It's simple, but it's profound. It's simple, and the way he delivers it makes it profound.
It's simple and it's clever. It reminds me, you know, I always go back to the John Lennon lyric, "Baby, you're a rich man." You know, like, I love any time you can make that perfect circle. He's just, you know, he's great. And what's funny about a lot of these songs is, you know, it, being a part of the hip-hop generation, I didn't know a lot of these were, you know, Bob Marley songs before my favorite hip-hop group interpolated.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, like, I think about, you know, everything's going to be all right. And that, the first time I heard that was in the Naughty by Nature song.
Sorry, everybody in the world. that was louder than I expected.
Really loud. But listen, sometimes you got to whisper it, but sometimes you got to scream.
So you're saying...
That was the dub version. But no, seriously, I also think about, you know, his line about, I think it's from Trench Town, one thing about music, when it hits, you feel no pain.
Yeah, I love that
line. That was used in everything from Drake to Dead Prez. Can I play a section?
Yeah.
One thing about music, when it hits, you feel no pain. White folks say...
And it was also used by none other than Drake on one of his very first songs. The track is Over.
Till it's over, till it's over, but it's far from over.
One thing about music, when it hits you, feel no pain.
I mean, there's about, honestly, there's about 10 years between those songs and about 20 years between them and Trench Town. So that's...
Yeah.
You know, that lyric, which I never knew was an interpolation, is pretty fun.
Let's talk a little bit about samples and interpolations. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Well, the song Jammin' was sampled by the Jungle Brothers with Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, and Moni Love. That's right. The entire Native Tongues crew came together in 1989 for Doing Our Own Dang.
Don't follow the path that we're stepping. Truth to the soul is what I'm cramming. Reasons for this is the family strong, like Bob Marley said. Singing's believing, so singing.
I love it when they do that in hip-hop songs, right? Or in any song, when it's just like a little fragment from the lyrics.
The tiniest bit.
The tiniest little bit, and it reflects what was just like mentioned in the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to just Bob saying jamming, because they just name-drop Bob Marley in the lyrics.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And then now this next one isn't a sample, it's an homage, but we alluded to Stevie Wonder and the connection between Stevie and Bob a little earlier. Big fans of each other's work. They played a couple times together. One time was the 1975, what was called the Wonder Dream Concert, which was actually the first time that Peter Tosh, Buddy Wailer, and Bob Marley were together on stage since 1973, when they all went their separate ways. They came up for this one show, and it was the last time they ever played together. So Stevie Wonder brought everyone together for one last hurrah.
I love that.
And then a little bit later, Stevie Wonder does a song called Master Blaster, which is an homage, including a lyric or two that I will play for you in a second, that quotes the song Jammin'. Here, I'll play it for you now.
Tonight there will be a party on the corner at the end of the block. Didn't know you would be jamming until the break of dawn. Sing nobody ever told you that you...
First off, one of my favorite Stevie Wonder songs.
So good, right?
Really
so
good. And it also has like that swing beat, the Steppers beat.
It's got the same Steppers beat that Jammin' has.
Yeah.
The same kind of swing feel to it as well.
Exactly. And Doing It to Death by Fred Wellesley and the JBs. Like, that's got that dun 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 dun.
That's a triplet feel, so it's like 6/8 time. But the thing about swing and triplets is that they're connected.
Mm.
In a sense, now there's many different variations of swing.
Sure.
Rhythm has all kinds of variety between the notes of the bar, but essentially da 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 swing you can think of as being two of the three triplets.
Yeah.
In a triplet.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So they are related.
I will say Latch by Disclosure has that
6/8 feel.
As a DJ, those are really hard songs to mix in and out of.
You kind of have to go into another one of them.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember one time I was like, I'm going to put all of them together and blow people's mind. But like, it can be tricky when you're trying to blend in and blend out of those.
Exactly. All right, so buckle up for this next one. This is not, I've got a little tale to tell you about One Love. So there's a lot of complexity to the song One Love itself, the Bob Marley song, has two versions. Let's start with that. It's first recorded by the Wailers, so with Bunny and Peter and Bob, in 1965. And here that is.
One love, one heart, let's join together and I'll feel all right.
So that's the original ska version of One Love. And when we get to the verse, we have this melody. Pay attention to the melody. And as you're listening, ask yourself if it reminds you of something else.
And I might pass on your dirty remark. One soul. There is one question I'd really like to ask.
One soul.
Is there a place for the hopeless sinner who has earned all mankind just to save the soul?
Does that melody ring any bells to you? It's pretty close to this in my ears. This is People Get Ready by The Impressions, written by Curtis Mayfield.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage.
It's just the shape of the melody is very similar. And in fact, that first version, just to set it all up, there are four different competing credits for this song across 50 years. One of them is that Curtis Mayfield is a co-writer of the song. In other words, that's an interpolation. And he is given credit for it. In some version of the world, he's getting some royalties in certain countries. Who the hell knows? It is so complicated. I spent 20 minutes talking to my friend who is helping me research this. But in another world, Cox and Dodd has an ownership claim.
Oh.
It was re-recorded in 1977 for the version most people know.
One love, one heart. Let's get together and feel all right.
If you've ever noticed, this song is called One Love / People Get Ready. Because when it was re-released, they did go back and credit and give 50% of the songwriting credits, it should be said, to Curtis Mayfield for that interpolation. In the original version, too, but the original version does not give credit because of complexity of Jamaican publishing. It's such a behind-the-scenes quagmire of complexity. So there's a lot of different competing stories, a lot of people competing for the dollars, obviously coming from this song. But that's One Love, as simplified as I could make it. Yeah. There's more that I left out of it. But I'm going to leave you on one more fun note. If you're familiar with the song Buffalo Soldier, you may have noticed the connection.
Oh, yeah, I know this story.
Yeah, to another song. Here's Buffalo Soldier. Now, Diallo, does that remind you of anything?
Maybe something that used to come on Saturday mornings.
That's right. It's very, 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 very similar to the song, the Tra-La-La song by the Banana Splits, a late 60s kids show, basically.
Yeah.
A bunch of very strange to our modern eyes, like costume, kind of creepy costumes. Like
everything from that
Five Nights
period
at Freddy's
kind of creepy.
Looking, yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've heard, this story kind of reminds me of Rod Stewart going down to Brazil, hearing something and not realizing. And I think that the story is that Bob was he touring America? Like, where did he get exposed to the trial?
He was touring America. So he had a friend named King Sporty, who's Jamaican, and who moved to America. So King Sporty is a friend of Bob Marley's who moves to Miami in the early 70s. He wrote the song Buffalo Soldier. And he produced the original demo, which I'll play for you now, by the way. This is fun. This is Bob Marley recording the original demo in Miami towards the end of the Kaya tour in 1980. And here it is. It's like a cocaine.
Is this 77?
That's 1980, and it's like super cocaine disco.
It's like disco.
Yeah, it's
fast,
too.
I never thought Bob would do disco.
It's like high energy, like Sylvester, like super speedy disco. So there was actually a BBC investigation I found where they were like, well, Bob Marley was never in America. He couldn't. And they basically, their conclusion leaves out the possibility that King Sporty was in America and definitely had access to watching the Banana Splits in the 70s, as we did. So my theory is that, I think it's such a direct connection melodically. The rhythm is the same.
Yeah.
Even the chord change is the same.
So maybe, it might be a case where King Sporty brought you know, this
I believe King Sporty
and Bob had no idea who the Tralalas were.
I'm pretty sure that's right. King Sporty is credited. He gets 66% writing credits on this versus Bob. There's one more piece of the story, though, in case anyone's worried that the Banana Splits are going to sue. The Tralala song is credited to the TV show's music directors, these Mark Barkin and Richie Adams, but the person who actually claims to have written the song was a for-hire jingle writer named N.B. Winkless. So he worked for the ad agency.
I'm sorry, what was that name again?
His name is Winkless. N.B. Winkless. He doesn't have
N.B.? How does he spell the first name?
Oh, it's like N.B. The letters N and B.
Oh, I thought his name was like E-M-B-E-E. I was like, what a weird first name
that
is.
It's still an unusual name.
N.B. Winkless.
He's N.B. Winkless Jr., by the way. His dad liked the name so much. Gave it to him. So this is a gentleman who wrote the jingle under the auspices of being a salaried employee for the ad agency Leo Burnett for Kellogg. This is like the 60s TV weirdness with like ad agencies.
It's like, yeah, that's like Mad Men era. Yeah,
exactly right. So I think at the end of the day, it's probably, I'm going to go with that's the Tralala song that was interpolated into Buffalo Soldier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my theory.
That's awesome. Now, luxury, Bob Marley, One Love, the Bob Marley biopic was released this year. It holds a 43% among the critics on Rotten Tomatoes, but this is interesting. The audience score is like 92%.
That's so...
Like, the people
discrepancy is major.
Love it.
Yeah.
How did you like it?
I thought it was really good, I have to say.
Yeah.
And this is the trouble where you see a biopic for someone you know a lot about. You really only, it's like the opposite. You see only the discrepancies.
Totally.
You don't see the bigger picture because you're distracted by the things that aren't quite right.
What was one of the inaccuracies, or let's just say, one of the changes that the people took a lot of creative license with?
I mean, listen, I'm not the only one who noticed this, but there's a scene where we talked about Cox and Dodd. Mm-hmm. The scene where they go in and meet Cox and Dodd and they end up recording Simmer Down. Before they get to that point, Cox and Dodd shows up with a gun and he's like threatening them, which I don't believe happened in real life. I think what that really is they're conflating two of the famous sound system operators of the day.
Yeah.
Cox and Dodd was one, and Duke Reed was one of the other ones. I mentioned him before in the Big Tree conversation. Duke Reed famously was a cop who brought his gun everywhere. So my guess is that they decided, well, let's meld the lore together.
But that wasn't really Cox and Dodd's style,
I don't think
right?
that was really Cox and Dodd. And Cox and Dodd's children don't think so either because they're really pissed and they're threatening to sue or something like that. But they're out there vocally saying, that's not our father.
So 1 out of 5 stars.
Well, for the Cox and Dodd depiction, I actually liked the movie because I love the story. I love the man. And actually, it's kind of a coincidence that we ended up using this song, which is the centerpiece of the movie as well.
Oh, wow.
The Jammin' is in the, as we discussed on the episode, the two concerts where they're bookended by the Smile Jamaica and One Love, that's also where the movie kind of takes over.
Yeah, totally.
So that was kind of fun to watch that in preparation for the episode. But like I said, that one little distraction shouldn't take away from what's an overall...
No, it shouldn't, but you know, little details like that matter.
Picture.
There was one moment from the movie that got turned into a GIF that got sent to me a lot, and it shows... Bob Marley giving, I assume, Chris Blackwell or his manager, I guess that's to be Blackwell.
I think it was Blackwell.
Gives him a fist bump.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a second. It's early 70s.
Yeah.
Like, the fist bump was not a thing in the early
70s. You don't
think
he would have been doing that then?
No, the fist bump, the history of the fist bump, I don't know why I even know this. it sort of starts with American black GIs in Vietnam, but it doesn't become a thing that like everybody's doing until like the early to mid 80s.
A Jamaican man and a British man might not necessarily
it's just
be doing
like
it.
Little details like that will really throw me out. I mean, he looked less like Bob Marley, he looked a little more like Bro Marley, but I'm definitely gonna see the movie.
Yeah.
But I'm a stickler like that because I make, you know, TV shows and movies. They gotta get the facts right.
I know. And sometimes you've got to put in a lot of the like exposition, right? All the facts have to go in. So you have to have a character that embodies five actual people or something like that.
Sure, in the interest of time, but like a fist bump, I don't know about that.
Diallo, you're a writer and a movie lover, from what I understand. seems to me like musical biopics are often kind of bad. Why do you think that is?
Listen, it's just like there was a scene in Straight Outta Compton, which I actually think is a decent
movie. I like that movie. Yeah,
I liked it. But there's like a scene like, hey, Ice Cube, what are you working on? Oh, I'm writing the screenplay for Friday. Like, that conversation
that's the exposition thing.
Did not happen.
That's what I mean. They've got to put all the exposition in. Like, here's what I am doing right now in order to tee up the next part of my life.
At a laptop. But, you know, I understand that. But there's a difference between that, like getting a detail wrong, and some things that I think are just misguided from the start. I am not a fan of Clint Eastwood's Charlie Parker biopic Bird.
That was on my list
don't
to see.
Like it.
You don't think I should
don't
see
like,
it?
Well,
not
no,
good?
Watch it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you need to watch it. Yeah. My problem with that is that I feel like they paint Charlie Parker as a heroin addict who happened to be a genius, not a genius who happened to use heroin. And I just think that I think that's telling the story from a completely misguided POV.
Is it sending the wrong message? Like heroin equals genius. Like,
well,
we've seen
I mean,
that
there were enough jazz
times.
Musicians who followed him down that road erroneously. But I also think that you know what the story Clint wants to tell to me is not what made Charlie Parker special. So Bird, not a big fan.
Okay.
Luxury, help me in this thing.
All right. Well, I'm producer, DJ, musicologist, and songwriter Luxury.
And I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ, T.L.O. Riddle.
This has been One Song. If you've enjoyed the episode, and you have, because you stayed all the way to the end, which means that you should go on to the favorite podcast platform of your choice, give us the 5 stars we have earned so clearly, possibly write a review, and tell all your friends. But until then, we'll see you next time, and don't forget...
Interpolation.
And don't forget...
Interpolation.
I know you're not going to use that, but I did it twice anyway.
This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson with engineering from Marcus Hum, additional production support from Casey Simonson. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, Eric Weil, and Leslie Guam. I'm out.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Nexco, give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience.
Acura wins Daytona.
And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Nexco, give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.